So back in 2015, a really massive stretch of the Pacific Ocean just suddenly spiked. We're talking like 8 degrees Celsius above normal.
Yeah, which is just a staggering anomaly for the ocean.
Right. And it was this phenomenon that scientists ominously nicknamed the blob.
The blob, yeah. Great name.
I mean, to someone standing on the beach in California, the water probably just looked a little more inviting for a swim.
Sure, maybe a bit warmer than usual.
But beneath the surface, that invisible temperature spike was it was actively triggering this permanent 8.7% plunge in total marine life for the region.
It was devastating.
It really was. So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are taking you into the unseen mechanics of the ocean. Our mission is to explore this monumental 2025 study from the journal Biogeosciences.
Right, by researchers Gibor Deluzinay, Chung, and Gascoul.
Exactly. And we're going to figure out exactly how these short, really intense bursts of heat, known as marine heat waves, are completely rewiring the global underwater food web.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is that we aren't just talking about, a brief period of uncomfortably warm water.
Right, like fish just swimming north for a week to cool off.
Exactly. No, we are looking at massive metabolic shockwaves. These temperature anomalies, they fundamentally alter the actual physical flow of energy from microscopic plankton all the way up to the apex predators.
Which creates damage that just compounds year after year.
Exactly. It's cumulative.
And the scale of this research is just staggering. I mean, the authors didn't just study a single bay.
Right, or track like one specific pod of whales.
No, they modeled the entire global ocean ecosystem from 1998 all the way to 2021.
It's a massive undertaking. They used the system called the Ecotroph-DIN model.
Ecotroph-DIN, right.
Yeah, and they essentially chopped the entire world's oceans into this vast grid, measuring 1 degree of longitude by 1 degree of latitude.
Wow.
And then they analyzed the biological activity in 15-day increments.
Over decades. I mean, to even attempt something on that scale, you have to
Yeah.
find a way to measure the unmeasurable.
Oh, absolutely. You obviously can't put a physical thermometer or a scale in every single square mile of the
All right,
ocean.
that's impossible. So the Ecotroph-DIN model, it relies on two massive streams of daily satellite data.
Right.
The first is sea surface temperature, and the second is net primary production, or NPP.
Yeah, but you have to remember, satellites are orbiting in space.
Right. They can't see the individual fish.
Exactly. They can't weigh the biomass beneath the waves, so they must be looking at color, right?
Oh, right. Like the green from the algae.
Yeah, if you see a lot of green in a satellite image of the ocean, that means chlorophyll. And chlorophyll means plant life, specifically phytoplankton.
Which is the base energy entering the food web.
That is the exact logic. So the researchers use this very specific mathematical formula to translate the intensity of that green color on the satellite images into a concrete measurement of carbon energy.
Okay, wow.
And that raw energy, the net primary production, that's the absolute foundation of the ecosystem. It tells us, how much fuel is entering the system on any given day.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because trying to visualize a mathematical grid of chlorophyll and carbon energy is, well, it's a bit abstract for anyone who isn't a marine biologist.
Very abstract, yeah.
So if you're trying to picture how this model works, think of the ocean's food web like a massive, invisible factory assembly line.
Okay, I like that.
That net primary production, the phytoplankton, that is the raw material being dumped onto the conveyor belt at the start of the factory.
Right.
Now, the paper focuses on two crucial metrics for how this factory operates: flow kinetics and transfer efficiency.
Right, exactly.
In our factory, the flow kinetics is simply the speed of the conveyor belt. It's just how fast the raw material moves from one station to the next.
And then the transfer efficiency measures how much of that product actually makes it to the end of the line.
To the apex predators.
Right, exactly, without getting dropped, spoiled, or wasted along the way. To translate that back from your factory analogy into the actual underlying biology, transfer efficiency represents the physiological balance between anabolism and catabolism in a living organism.
Okay, so it's like the cost of doing business versus the profit.
Precisely. That's a great way to put it. Anabolism is the profit. It's the growth.
Building muscle and stuff.
Yeah, building new tissue, bulking up muscle, basically creating a larger fish that provides a bigger meal for whatever eats it next.
Right.
But catabolism is the overhead cost. It's the basal metabolism and respiration. I mean, it's the sheer amount of energy an organism burns just to pump blood, process oxygen, and stay alive.
Just to exist.
Exactly. When an organism consumes food, a really large chunk of that energy goes purely towards surviving.
Okay.
And only the leftover energy goes into growth, which is, you know, the only energy successfully passed up the food chain to the next predator.
So that's the product successfully moving down the assembly line.
Right.
And the flow kinetics, the speed of that conveyor belt. I assume that must change depending on what part of the factory you're looking at.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, if you are looking at lower trophic levels, mm-hmm. the tiny forage fish and plankton, that belt is running at lightning speed.
Because those species live fast and die young.
Exactly. But for the great white sharks and bluefin tuna at the end of the line, the belt basically crawls.
Yeah, it's a highly calibrated system. Raw materials enter, the belt moves, energy is transferred with, you know, a natural amount of metabolic waste, and eventually the system supports apex predators.
Under normal conditions.
Right, that calibration assumes a stable environment. But the entire premise of this study is introducing a catastrophic disruptor to the factory floor.
Severe thermal stress.
Exactly. Severe thermal stress.
Which brings us to the definition of a marine heat wave. Because this study defines it with very strict mathematical parameters.
Yeah, it's not just a hot day.
Right. A marine heat wave is a period of more than 5 consecutive days where the local water temperature exceeds the 90th percentile of historical temperatures for that exact 1 degree grid square.
And they measure historical against a 30-year baseline from 1982 to 2011.
So we're talking about extreme sustained heat relative to whatever the local normal used to be.
And you really have to consider how marine animals process heat, because most of them are ectotherms.
Meaning cold-blooded.
Basically, yeah. Their internal body temperature is dictated entirely by the water surrounding them. They can't sweat.
They can't just seek air conditioning.
Right, exactly. So when a heat wave strikes, their basal metabolism just goes into overdrive. It's the physiological equivalent of forcing them to run a marathon while standing completely still.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they burn immense amounts of energy, that catabolism we talked about, just trying to survive the sheer thermal shock.
So they're burning through all their fuel just to stay alive, which means there is zero energy left for anabolism.
None. There is no growth.
The transfer efficiency completely tanks, and the biological product is just falling off the assembly line.
Exactly. And because their metabolic demands are so incredibly high and they're suddenly starved for energy, these organisms compensate using the only mechanism available to them, predation activity spikes.
They just start eating frantically.
Right. The conveyor belt speeds up, the flow kinetics increase rapidly. Because the environment is suddenly hostile, the long-term slow-growing species get outcompeted.
Because they can't adapt fast enough.
Yeah. The entire food web begins to be dominated by small, short-lived, fast-growing species that can reproduce before the heat kills them.
And the global numbers the model spit out are just brutal.
Mm.
I mean, when they ran the simulation, they found that the top predators' trophic levels, 4 to 5.5, saw a massive heat wave-induced biomass drop of 4.4%.
Yeah.
But the lower levels only saw a drop of 3.4%. But wait, if predation activity goes up and the whole system speeds up, shouldn't the top predators be getting an all-you-can-eat buffet?
You would think so.
Yeah, if the ocean is suddenly swarming with fast-breeding small fish,
mm-hmm.
why do the sharks and tuna suffer the absolute worst drop at 4.4%?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it really comes down to a fundamental ecological concept called biomass residence time. Think about the life cycle of a sardine versus the life cycle of an apex predator. A great white shark, for example, takes over a decade just to reach sexual maturity.
Right.
So they have incredibly slow turnover rates. When a heat wave hits, it operates as a rapid, violent pulse. The lower levels of the food web, the small, fast-growing species, they take a massive hit. But they can rebuild their populations in a matter of weeks or months.
Because their generations are so incredibly short, they just reproduce fast enough to adapt to the shock.
Exactly. But the top predators cannot. They are biologically incapable of recovering quickly enough from the energy gaps and food shortages happening beneath them on the assembly line.
So they just starve.
Right. And by the time a shark or a tuna begins to recover its population from one period of starvation, the next heat wave pulse strikes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the rapid frequency of these extreme events just entirely outpaces the time that high-level predators need to heal and repopulate. The damage at the top naturally compounds.
It's like the big complex machinery in the factory takes years to repair, while the cheap small parts can just be swapped out overnight.
That's a perfect way to look at it.
So if we apply this logic, if extreme heat destroys transfer efficiency and breaks the system, you would assume the equator, you know, the naturally hottest part of the ocean, must be an absolute dead zone.
It's a logical assumption.
Does this mathematical devastation apply equally everywhere?
Actually, no. It varies wildly depending on the local geography. And the paper divides the ocean into three main biomes to track this.
Okay, let's look at those.
Let's start with the tropical biomes. The tropics are the most vulnerable ecosystems on the planet right now. They are already operating on a razor's edge, incredibly close to their absolute thermal limits.
Because the baseline water temperature is already so warm.
Exactly. So their transfer efficiency is naturally very low to begin with.
So they're constantly relying on a fast conveyor belt just to survive normal conditions.
Right. And when a marine heat wave hits a tropical biome, it just pushes them past their physiological breaking point. The model showed total consumer biomass in the tropics dropping an average of 0.23% every single year.
Every single year.
Yeah, but in specific global biodiversity hotspots, we're talking places like the water surrounding Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and Central America. These heat waves caused up to 20% additional biomass loss.
20% wiped off the map. I mean, that is catastrophic for the communities relying on those reefs.
It really is.
But in temperate biomes, the waters further from the equator, the story shifts a bit, right?
It does. The baseline transfer is slower. When heat waves strike there, they tend to be incredibly high intensity, but they are relatively short in duration.
So it's a violent shock, but a brief one.
Exactly. The assembly line stutters and jams, but it doesn't completely collapse. This leads to much lower overall biomass losses.
Which brings us to the third category, and honestly, one of the most fascinating findings in the data, the upwelling biomes.
Yes, the upwelling zones.
These are highly specific coastal areas where deep ocean currents are forced upward to the surface by the shape of the continental shelf. And the paper notes that these zones experience marine heat waves averaging 23 days a year with incredibly high intensity.
Yeah, almost a full month.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If upwelling zones are dealing with nearly a month of extreme boiling heat every single year, why aren't they completely devastated like the tropics?
It's a great question.
How are they surviving a 23-day metabolic shockwave?
They survive because of the unique physical properties of the deep ocean water being pulled to the surface. Upwelling zones act as these biological refuge areas.
Oh, okay.
Because gravity is constantly pulling dead organic matter, marine snow, decaying fish down to the ocean floor, and down there it decomposes into this dense, incredibly rich nutrient soup.
Sounds lovely.
It's life-saving for the ecosystem. Upwelling currents pull that freezing, nutrient-dense water straight up into the sunlight.
So it's like flooding the factory with an unlimited stockpile of premium raw materials.
Exactly. That influx of nutrients creates an environment of staggering primary productivity and immense biodiversity. And that high productivity gives the ecosystem a built-in resilience. It acts as a massive biological buffer.
So they have a cushion.
Right. Even when the heat hits and metabolic demands skyrocket, the food web is just so robust and resource-rich that it can absorb the blow without the food chain snapping.
Wow, it's like having a reinforced foundation in an earthquake zone.
Yeah, but even the most reinforced foundations have a breaking point.
True.
And we actually saw what that breaking point looks like in real life. The researchers didn't just run theoretical simulations. They used their model to perform an autopsy on one of the most devastating marine heat waves in modern history.
We mentioned it at the start, the Northeast Pacific Marine Heat Wave from 2013 to 2016, known as the Blob.
Right. The Blob is the ultimate textbook example of what happens when the slow, long-term press of global climate change suddenly meets a violent, short-term pulse of extreme heat. The temperature anomalies in the Northeast Pacific reached an astonishing 8 degrees Celsius above average in 2015.
8 degrees Celsius. I mean, if the ocean were a living body, that is a terminal fever.
Absolutely.
So what did the model reveal about the actual biomass during those 3 years?
Well, the simulation hindcasted an 8.7% decline in total consumer biomass due to this specific event.
That's massive.
It is. But it wasn't just a simple reduction in fish numbers. It was a fundamental, chaotic shifting of the entire biological neighborhood. They observed a massive phenomenon called tropicalization.
Tropicalization, meaning species that belong near the equator suddenly started migrating north to escape the heat.
Pushing into territories they had never inhabited before.
Right. The California Current suddenly saw an influx of warm water, fast-growing predators like tuna, sailfish, and marlin.
which completely upends the local food web. But the most disruptive element of the tropicalization was a massive bloom of pyrosomes in the California Current.
Oh, right, the pyrosomes. What even are those?
They are bizarre. There are these tube-like gelatinous organisms that thrive in warm, low-nutrient water, and they bloomed in such catastrophic numbers that they essentially acted as a massive energy trap.
They broke the conveyor belt. I mean, if the normal phytoplankton is high-quality fuel, the pyrosomes are like replacing the food on the assembly line with packing peanuts.
That is painfully accurate. They consume massive amounts of the primary production, but almost no higher predators are actually adapted to eat gelatinous tubes.
Oh, wow.
So the energy goes into the pyrosomes and just stops. It gets permanently stuck at that station and never reaches the larger fish.
Meanwhile, further north in the Gulf of Alaska, the heat caused a dramatic and deadly shift in the plankton community, didn't it?
Yes. The extreme heat caused the surface water to stratify, which prevented deeper nutrients from mixing upward. And without those nutrients, the large, fat-rich plankton died off.
And they were replaced by what?
They were rapidly replaced by smaller, far less nutritious plankton species.
So the actual nutritional value of the ocean's foundation just plummeted.
Exactly.
The forage fish starved because their food lost its fat content, which in turn starved the seabirds and the marine mammals. It really reminds you of an earthquake.
How so?
Well, the initial temperature spike of the blob, that 8-degree anomaly, that is the tremor. But the migration of the warm water tuna, the invasion of the pyrosomes, the starving of the plankton.
Nah.
Well, I should say, those are the ecological tsunamis that wipe out the top predators years after the ground stops shaking.
That's a powerful analogy. And that leads directly to the most alarming finding from the entire simulation.
What's that?
Well, when the researchers ran the timeline forward to the end of their study period in 2021, they specifically looked for signs of ecosystem recovery from the blob. The lower trophic levels, you know, the small, fast-breeding forage fish, they showed some minor bounce back. But the medium and high trophic levels, the top predators, they showed absolutely zero sign of recovery from the 2013 to 2016 event.
Wait, really? 5 years later, and the top of the food chain is still permanently stunted?
Zero recovery. And this raises an important question, perhaps the most critical question of the entire paper. We have the long-term press of global climate change, right?
Which is slowly raising the baseline temperature of the ocean over decades.
Exactly. And superimposed on top of that, we have these short-term pulses, the marine heat waves. Because the overall baseline is higher, these pulses are hitting with unprecedented ferocity, and they are hitting ecosystems that never had the biological time to heal from the last heat wave.
The pulses are striking faster than the predator's biomass residence time can handle.
Yeah.
We are repeatedly kicking the factory while it's already offline, basically preventing any chance of long-term repair. So taking a step back and looking at this massive grid of data from 1998 to 2021,
yeah,
what we are seeing is that marine heat waves are not just a temporary uncomfortable summer for the local wildlife.
No, not at all.
They are metabolic wrecking balls. They destroy transfer efficiency, they force the flow kinetics into overdrive, and they permanently rewire the ocean's food assembly line, disproportionately wiping out the apex predators.
And this is a reality you have to keep in mind the next time you hear about ocean temperatures rising, because this isn't abstract mathematics playing out on a supercomputer in some university basement.
Right.
This permanent rewiring dictates the survival of global fisheries.
Yeah.
It determines the availability, the cost, and the quality of the seafood on your dinner table.
It affects all of us.
On a macro level, it dictates the basic biological stability of our blue planet. When the apex predators disappear, the downward pressure on the food web vanishes, and the entire structure of the ocean fundamentally changes.
It makes you look at the shoreline very differently.
It really does.
But before we wrap up, there is one final, almost hidden detail in this biogeosciences paper that we need to unpack. The entire simulation, this massive global model of metabolic shock and devastation, actually hinged on a single vital mathematical assumption.
Yes. The researchers built the model utilizing a parameter they called alpha.
Alpha.
Yeah, alpha represents the resistance capacity of the species in the ocean. Essentially, it is the mathematical representation of a species' genetic ability to acclimate to thermal stress before they succumb to mortality.
Okay, so it asks the question, how much heat can these specific animals tolerate before their basal metabolism simply fails?
Exactly.
But science doesn't fully know the genetic limits of every single species in the ocean, right?
Right.
So how do they even calculate that for a global model?
They have to make an educated biological baseline. They assumed an alpha of 6.2.
Okay, and what does that mean?
This means they modeled the ocean under the assumption that 20% of the species would be unable to adapt and would die when subjected to severe thermal stress. They tested other values, of course. An alpha of 1, where absolute mortality occurs across the board, and an alpha 0, where every species perfectly and instantly adapts. But they settled on 0.2 as the most scientifically realistic baseline, given our current understanding of marine biology.
So what does this all mean for the future? We'll leave you with this final thought. The models we discussed today, the terrifying drops in biomass and the collapse of the apex predators, they show us the devastation based on the biology we understand today, operating with an alpha of 0.2.
Right.
The model assumes an 80% success rate for adaptation, and the outcomes are still catastrophic. What if the ultimate wild card for the future of our oceans isn't just the rising temperature?
It's a scary thought.
What if it's an invisible microscopic race against time? Will marine species be able to rapidly genetically rewrite their own thermal limits, essentially upgrading their own alpha before the next heat wave strikes? When you look out at that calm, flat, blue expanse of the ocean, just remember, beneath the surface, that desperate race for survival is already happening.